Hi, I'm Marisa McClellan, author of Food in Jars.
And I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly. Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk about living the food life in Philadelphia and beyond. This week we're talking about quesadillas, the Silver Palette Cookbook, and we're talking with Camille Storch of Old Blue Raw Honey. But first, let's compare notes on something we read this week. How about the sugar shortage?
I know, this is sort of scary. But so apparently, thanks to the El Nino weather system that we've been having, it has impacted the sugar cane harvest. And it looks like we're going to have a shortage of cane sugar over the next year.
Maybe that's not such a bad thing.
I had the exact same thought, just because we're all trying to eat less sugar. And so perhaps this is an excuse of sugar. It's like when people don't drive as much because gas prices have gone up.
Right. And the story suggested that for the past few years, there's been kind of a surplus of sugar and prices have been perhaps artificially low.
Yeah, that is true. And it is interesting, you know, so I just wrote this book about natural sweeteners and didn't use any refined sugar in it. And those alternative sweeteners are more expensive, but maybe that's the true cost of sugar, are those higher prices that you get, you pay for, you know, honey or maple, things like that.
Right.
And I do think that if people end up exploring other sweeteners more as a way of responding to the sugar shortage, that could be actually a really good thing, both culinarily and just perhaps for, you know, people's awareness of what it really costs to eat sweet things.
One thing it made me think a lot about is, you know, I don't really think that most people's sugar consumption goes into overdrive at home.
That is true.
When they're scooping the white sugar from their bin for baked homemade baked goods or sprinkling it in their coffee or whatever, I think the real overconsumption of sugar happens out in the prepared food space. So if it maybe drives up the price of those sugary drinks at the coffee bar or prepared food at the store and maybe brings those prices up and slows people down buying them, I can't say that that makes me mad.
That's true. I wonder, too, if food manufacturers will look harder at the amount of sugar they add to things. I mean, probably not, because they're all about getting people hitting that sweet spot of sort of fatty, sugary, salty to get you addicted.
Of course, the other reason is sugar, as you very well know, is such an effective preservative.
That is true.
That's another reason why we see sugar in everything that we eat. But I would not feel at all annoyed to see sugary prices go up, even of things like, you know, the hidden sugar and ketchup, prepared marinara sauces, salad dressings. Like, if those prices were higher, maybe people would think twice about buying them and make them at home. Yeah. Although, I mean, I know that that's probably wishful thinking on my part, but I would like to think something would stop people from doing it. And I mean, the cost of so many of those things are artificially low anyway, you know, because of subsidies and economies of scale. I guess I don't think that a few cents more per can of soda is going to stop anybody, but...
Yeah, no, it's just, it'll be an interesting thing to watch and see if it has any impact.
It's hardly as scary as the chocolate shortage.
True enough. True enough. Or the butter shortage we had a few years back. Now right. That was truly...
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I do think that we're very used to cheap food, and anything that makes us more sensitive to the actual cost of things is not a tragedy for me.
I agree. I know. It'll just be interesting. If you have any thoughts about sugar shortages or how you think it might impact people's eating habits, or if it, you don't think it will at all, just leave us a comment on localmouthful.com. So from sugar to what's for dinner. And this week we're going to talk about quesadillas as a easy, delicious, satisfying dinner option.
Quesadillas are a dinner that I often forget about and then come back to with great enthusiasm.
Yes, me too. I really first discovered quesadillas as a thing you could eat for dinner when I was in college. My mom, we did a lot of burrito nights when I was a kid, but we never did quesadillas. And the cafe at my college served one of the options, you know, if you were on one of these split meal plans, you could go occasionally and have eat at the cafe, which was always very exciting, and get a quesadilla. And I loved it. I just thought this was the best idea in the whole world. And my roommates and I would often have quesadilla night back at our little house. And so ever since then, I have been making quesadillas for dinner, and they make me very happy.
And what are some of your favorite fillings?
I really like to do sauteed vegetables. I mean, I'm always looking for ways to shoehorn more vegetables into life. It's just sort of my my MO. And so I do sauteed peppers and onions. I might do some, add some kale or spinach to that medley, and then layer that into tortillas with as little cheese as possible to hold it all together and still be delicious. I might also put a little chicken in there sometimes if I'm really trying to make it a complete meal.
I like a chicken quesadilla.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, one thing I do with my onions and peppers specifically is it's something I think I picked up in like a Rick Bayless cookbook.
Uh-huh.
But in Mexico, and I mean, come on, we're not talking about like authentic Mexican meals here.
No, this is strictly American Mexican
but
food.
But one thing they do in Mexico is they don't, for many things, the vegetables are not sauteed in oil. They're just charred in like a dry cast iron pan or whatever. Oh. So I will make a mix of red onions, peppers, jalapenos and corn, and like sort of char it all up in a dry pan, and then fold that into my cheese. And I really think that's a lovely approach.
That sounds so good.
It's not great if you're using like leafy green vegetables, but like for those other vegetables, it can really work out well.
I think that sounds amazing. I also am a big fan of a kimchi quesadilla. Talk about worlds colliding there. It's just basically, you know, cheese and a hefty layer of kimchi folded into a tortilla and grilled until it's all melty.
I've definitely enjoyed a grilled kimchi sandwich, but I haven't done it in a quesadilla, I don't think. That's a good idea.
I did it once. I know I wasn't the one who came up with the idea, but I got home from an event once and I was really hungry and we didn't have much to eat. But we had tortillas, cheese, and a jar of kimchi. And
done.
So I thought, okay, that's it. That's what I'm eating for dinner. And it was so good. There's just, you know, that sort of crazy tangy spiciness of the kimchi with melty cheese that cannot be beat. It's like this hot sauce all in one.
I like that too. That's really tasty. I also enjoy beans in my quesadilla.
I don't think I ever put beans in a quesadilla. I should though.
Especially if it's like something you're doing fast.
Yeah.
I usually like to cook my beans from dried, but I do keep canned beans on hand for emergencies, and that a quesadilla emergency is a worthy one.
Yeah. No, I think that that's really smart. It's very much like when my mom didn't have anything else to feed us when I was a kid. There were two options. She would either microwave a hot dog and a hot dog bun, which was a terrible thing, or better, she would make a quick bean and cheese burrito because at the time we lived in Southern California, and so there was always cheese and tortillas in the refrigerator. And yeah, so it's almost the same thing, just a little folded up tortilla with cheese and beans.
Well, let's talk about the tortilla part of this equation.
Yes.
I would not use a corn tortilla for a quesadilla, would you?
Only when I'm desperate.
I feel like that almost becomes a griddled taco.
Yeah, it really, it's not ideal. I've done it in the past in a moment of weakness when I didn't have any other options. But my preferred quesadilla sort of build is a nice, big, sturdy, partially whole wheat tortilla that I then fill on one side and fold so that you have at least one edge where you don't have ingredients escaping.
Right, right. That's a good method. I, too, employ the fold.
Mm-hmm.
I like Whole Foods 365 brand 100% whole wheat tortillas for quesadillas. I mean, don't get me wrong. I like a white flour tortilla, but I feel like it makes it a little healthier. It does make it healthier. You get more fiber.
Exactly.
And it's almost the same amount tasty, I would say.
Well, whenever you sort of toast or griddle a tortilla, I feel like it's pretty darn good. It's hard to go wrong. I tend to buy mine at Trader Joe's, which I think are probably almost the same thing. It's like a whole wheat.
They probably are
the exact same thing. And they're really good tortillas. I have in the past made the mistake of buying the ones that are like especially fibery. They're supposed to give you a really big dose of fiber, and they have like whole flax seeds in them. Mm-hmm. And that is taking the desire to be healthy one step too far, I feel like. It is not an adequate vehicle for melty cheese.
Right. I mean, I always say to myself and others, if something is so healthy you don't want to eat it, then it's not doing its job of making you healthier.
Exactly.
You know? Well, I think we should wrap up. Or fold up, as it were, this part of our conversation on quesadillas and move on to a less happy topic.
Yeah.
For me, at least.
The cookbook club.
Which is our cookbook club pick of the month, the Silver Palette Cookbook.
Yeah. So we picked the Silver Palette thinking that this was a classic, you know, that we wanted to both revisit. We wanted to visit new cookbooks and revisit old classics.
Its reputation is enormous.
It has sold, I think, something like 2.5 million copies. It's a ton of copies of this cookbook. It first came out in 1982, and it was born out of a gourmet food market in New York City. Julie Russo and Sheila Lukens were the authors, and people, you know, became the Bible for dinner parties across the country in the 80s. And the question really for us now is 34 years later, does it hold up? And Joy, what do you feel like?
Let me just give you guys a little backstory on this. We picked it, and I guess this was our April pick, right? Marisa went away on book tour, and I was left here with the Silver Palette cookbook. But in the back of my mind, I was like, Marisa's not cooking from this either. She's not here. I did, though. I sat down one night. I went through it, and I was like, God, there's nothing, like literally nothing in here I want to make. I paid close attention to that famous chicken Maribel recipe, and I was like, I just wouldn't do this. I mean, you put bone in, skin on chicken pieces in a marinade. And you kind of bake it in that marinade, and I'm like, what happens to the skin? I would take the skin off. And then I was like, actually, maybe I would do this with boneless, skinless thighs. And ultimately, I was like, you know, actually, I just want to make Melissa Clark's recipe for anchovy lemon chicken thighs. I don't actually want to make this at all. But then when you came back and we were like, oh, neither of us have cooked from this. Let's really buckle down. And I remember I said to you, I'm going to go to the grocery store today. I sat down with the book again, and I was like, you know what? No. No Silver Palette cookbook. And at that time, I had a flashback to I had taken it out of the library years ago based on its reputation and had the same experience, but I forgot.
Oh, funny. You know,
I forgot that I took it out of the library, and I looked through it for things to illegally, you know, scan and save. But I didn't – nothing appealed to me then, and nothing appealed to me now, and I'm just not going to cook stuff I don't want to. Instead, I remade the doll from the Indian Family Kitchen, which I love.
It's totally fair. So I hadn't really spent a lot of time with this book, but I will say that there was a lot of chicken Marbella in my childhood. So it is a very familiar dish. Like, I have cousins who made it and aunts, and I don't think my mom ever made it.
Doesn't the skin turn out weird?
Well, you know what? I think whoever I – like, so I always adapt it. I always do it with either boneless, skinless chicken – boneless, skinless chicken thighs or breasts. And that's the way I've always had it. Mm-hmm. So I just ignore that part. But yeah, if you made it the way – it would be so flabby and gross.
The other crazy thing is it calls for like 7 chickens. I know. I actually think it's like literally 5 chickens.
It's a ridiculous amount of food. But it is – it's designed for dinner party, so I'll give them that. But I have made it in the past. I'll confess I didn't make it again for this round. But having made it in the past, it's an acceptable chicken dish. I think it was the first time people in the 80s were like, oh my God, olives and prunes. Like, this sounds crazy. Let's try it.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I think I'd like it made with chicken thighs. It's just like at the point that I was at, well, I'm going to cut this in 2 quarters and I'm going to make this change. And then it was like, I was like, why don't I just make something that I actually want to make instead?
Totally acceptable.
But I know you buckled down and actually made some things. So why don't you tell us about it?
I made the chicken Marbella in the past, and then I made 2 things fresh this time. I made the tapenade dip and the lentil and walnut salad. And they were okay. They weren't the best things ever. They appealed to me simply because they were things I could keep in the refrigerator and eat for lunch. Mm-hmm. But each time I found myself needing to season more. I feel like this book suffers a little bit from the low-salt ethos of the early 80s. I did make a list as I was going through of about 16 dishes, including the 3 I just mentioned, that I thought, well, I mean, I might make these someday. But my feeling is that there's a better representative of this era. There's a book out there that's a better sort of late 70s, early 80s snapshot of the culinary scene that always has things I want to make in it. And that's the Frog Commissary Cookbook, which is out of Philadelphia. So it makes sense that it's not as famous as the Silver Palette, but it is certainly, to my mind, a more interesting book. There's a red lentil and currant salad, curried red lentils and currants in that book that I have made now, and people swoon over it. And it's so much more appealing than anything right. that I found in this book.
And I mean, if you think, I know this is maybe an unfair comparison, but how old is Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking?
Yeah.
It's still delicious now, you know, I guess because it's based on such timeless French technique.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, there's no trends there.
Yeah.
I don't know. I felt really left cold by it.
I also just, there were some ingredients that repeated over and over again that I thought, why?
Right.
Like, there was so much creme fraiche. Creme fraiche yeah. is delicious. Where was anyone getting creme fraiche in 1982?
I don't know.
I mean, everybody was probably subbing in sour cream.
And the weird fruit vinegar.
Yeah. And so many blueberries.
I think they sold that in their store,
they
actually.
They did. But so, like, blueberry mayonnaise.
Strange.
Who wants that?
Not me. Sorry, guys. We invited you into a conversation about this book, which we wanted to have. And I'm really glad that I explored it with a serious thought. But it's definitely not something I'm probably going to give my copy away or sell it.
Yeah.
Though that said, there were things in the dessert chapter that appealed to me.
There were a couple. Yeah, there were some bread, like quick breads and things like that, that I thought maybe I'll try this.
I almost made the banana date bread just for the sake of making something mm-hmm. from it. And then I was like, forget it. I'm just going to eat the whole thing and then hate myself for it. Frankly.
So. Well, you know what? I think this was an interesting exercise in trying to revisit old classics and finding them.
Or at least this one.
Yeah. I think that it'll be interesting in the future as we go through and continue to revisit old classics as right. well as new books to see what stands up and what doesn't.
True. And I mean, just because it didn't ring my bell doesn't mean it wouldn't be just the thing for someone else. I mean, taste is really an important thing. Sensibility, when you're looking at a cookbook, you know, if you have the same sort of flavor sensibilities as the author, a lot of times you're really key into it. I don't want to, you should definitely check it out of the library and look at it. It is a classic, but it's not one for me.
Yeah, no, I think that's perfectly acceptable. Our guest today on Local Mouthful is Camille Storch. She and her husband, Henry, have a honey company called Old Blue Raw Honey. They're based in the Willamette Valley in Oregon, and they are creating really interesting honeys. Camille, hi.
Hi. Nice to see you and talk to you today.
It's nice to see you and talk to you, too. We get to see each other about once a year, so it's always nice when we actually get to connect in person.
Yes, for sure.
So tell us a little bit about Old Blue Raw Honey.
So Old Blue is just my husband, Henry, and I. He's the beekeeper. He's been keeping bees for probably about 10 years. It started off on a hobby scale, and then about 3 years ago, really scaled up to more of a professional beekeeping operation. We have about 500 hives at this time, so it's sort of a large, small producer or a small, large producer. We do a lot of different interesting varietal honeys all in the Willamette Valley and the Oregon Coast Range. So my husband does all the beekeeping by himself, more or less. And then I do all the things that aren't beekeeping, marketing, photography, sales, shipping. If you ever add an event, it's probably me that's there. it's just the two of us and we're having a good time with it.
That sounds so great. So tell us a little bit more about the varieties of honey. Now, I know that because you guys, so you had mentioned you harvest multiple times a year so that you can really taste the variations of pollen and honey. So tell us a little bit more about what you guys do that's different from any other honey companies.
So our program is roughly split into two categories. We do crop pollination. So we pollinate, we bring our bees out to big fields of blooming crops, clary sage, coriander, raspberry, meadow foam, which is like a really kind of locally famous type of honey. So we do crop honeys and crop pollination services for farmers. We only work with farmers that we have a relationship with and that we know are going to be respectful of our beekeeping operation and try to minimize exposure to agricultural chemicals. Most of the growers that we work with actually are friends of my husband's he went to Oregon State and has an agriculture degree. Okay. So they're old friends, people we really like and respect. So we do crop honeys. Those are have really interesting different flavors. This year, I think the coriander might be the favorite, which isn't one we've ever done before, but people just are kind of freaking out about it. It's really delicious. We have a clary sage honey that's also like very popular. So that's the crop honeys. Then we also do wildland honeys in the Coast Range. The Oregon Coast Range is a pretty wild place, and we have our bees mostly in very remote areas on private land. My husband was a horseshoer, or still is a horseshoer, for like the last 10 years or so. So he knows all the Coast Range people. He's driven many, 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 you know, hundreds, thousands of miles in that area, and is kind of one of those guys who, you know, sees someone on the French porch and stops and chats and runs into someone at the gas station and, "Hi, I'm Henry. Mm-hmm. Who are you?" And so he has built all these relationships with Coast Range people. And so we bring our bees out to their property in the spring and summertime. And so most of the Coast Range apiaries, that's the name of a location where you have a bunch of hives. Most of the apiaries are in real remote locations, so very far from agricultural chemicals or large, you know, concentrations of ag area. And we also harvest honey, several times throughout the honey producing season. So the season starts out, with the, big leaf maple nectar flow. Vine maple also starts to bloom right about this time of year. And then poison oak, chitim, which is not a very impressive, Coast Range kind of large shrub, small tree. but it's a really important nectar flow for bees in the Coast Range in the early spring. And so with each location, we'll pull honey, out of the hives after each of the major nectar flows in the early spring. So we have like a big leaf maple honey. We have a poison oak honey that's made from poison oak flower nectar.
Wow.
Just wait, concentrated. I got it.
So what does poison oak honey taste like?
It's pretty mild. Like, really? It's not a really intensely flavorful. Like, we make big leaf maple honey, and it's one of the few honeys that we produce that sometimes when you have people try it, they make this horrible, puckery face, like, "This is awful, get this out of my mouth."
Interesting.
And then other people really, really like it. And it definitely has, like, a strong kind of menthol, cough drop, eucalyptus flavor, which is not necessarily something you would associate with maple trees. But, yeah, the honey is really interesting. And, yeah, it's kind of like you either love it or hate it. The poison oak honey is less controversial.
Okay.
It has a great flavor. It's a little bit more complex than the later season blackberry honey, which, like, blackberry honey in the Pacific Northwest is kind of the standard. Like, the non-native blackberries are all over in the Coast Range, which is unfortunate ecologically. But for us, we kind of get to, like, make lemonade out of lemons and, you know, produce something really positive out of, you know, this non-native invasion. Yeah. I have kind of similar feelings about the poison oak honey. Like, I get poison oak rash really badly.
Oh, no.
I don't like to be in it around it. It is native, so, you know, I can't complain too much. But making honey from poison oak is something good that can come out of it. But yeah, so we pull honey multiple times in the year. We have these weird early spring honeys that some of them have really strong flavors. And then towards June and July, the main season blackberry bloom is on. And that is what we produce the most of, like, by volume, like many, many, many times more blackberry honey than, say, poison oak honey or big leaf maple honey.
So tell us a little bit. I know you know, when we chatted earlier, you told me that in addition to producing honey, your husband is also working on breeding bees to be better able to survive in the Pacific Northwest.
Right. That's kind of how he got into doing beekeeping on a more of a commercial scale. We had a couple of hobby hives for a few years, and then he got a phone call. We have a lot of friends in the logging industry in our area. It's kind of a big part of that part of Oregon. And he had some friends that were doing some logging way, way, way out in the Coast Range, really remote area. And they had cut down several trees that had bees living inside a cavity in the log. And so then they hauled these logs into their logging area, and it was not only a problem for the loggers, but they also had enough, you know, wherewithal to realize that there was some value in these bees. And so they called my husband Henry. He went out and moved the bees from like the tree cavity into a hive. And so that was kind of the basis of our program, was these bees that had come either from swarms that he caught out in the Coast Range or from bee trees, where they had been living in areas where there had been no commercial bees for many, many, many years, like decades. But these hives, these colonies had been surviving without any management for many years. Wow. And propagating throughout the Coast Range. So when he saw these bees, it was like, whoa, these are different. These don't look like, you know, the bees that you can get in packages from California. They look different. They're acting different. And this is kind of interesting. And I wonder what I can do with this. So in the last probably 5 or 6 years, he's been raising almost all his own queens and doing a pretty intense breeding and selection program, trying to develop bees that are better adapted to the Northwest, that will survive and will make honey and will be suitable for also for migratory pollination, like moving hives to farmers' fields. He raises almost all his own queens. Some of the characteristics he's looking for in his bees, in the selection process, is like wing strength, so ability to fly farther distances to get resources, nectar and pollen resources, ability to fly in cooler temperatures, okay, which is important for survival and for making early spring honeys, because the weather in Oregon is cool, often marginal in the spring. And so if they can get out and get going when it's cooler, like, that gives them a leg up. Also what's called hygienic behavior, which is a characteristic where the bees can sense which of the brood, the baby bees that are still in cap cells before they hatch. Some of them will have mites on them, which is, you know, parasites. That's one of the biggest challenges facing beekeepers and bees right now is the varroa mites. And so some hives will be able to sense that there's mites in certain cells, and they'll pull the baby bees and pitch them before they hatch to basically clean the hives or keep the mite load to a minimum. And lots of other characteristics too, but 5 or 6 years in, we're really starting to see the results of the selection process, and pretty consistently, like, our own genetics outperform other hives that we have that have queens from various other places.
That is so interesting. Really cool. So tell us where we can find your honey.
So we sell online. It's actually oldbluenaturalresources.com, or just Google Old Blue Raw Honey. We have, I think it's upwards of 14 different varietals for sale currently. Not all of them are wildly different. Some of the differences are a little bit more subtle. So online is a great place to find us. We also do occasional events in Portland and in our small community of like Philomath, Corvallis area, if you're ever passing through Oregon. And one of the things that we're doing now, which I'm really excited about, is basically the equivalent of like a Honey of the Month club.
Oh, cool.
So it's like a subscription membership where we do 3 different honey varietals every 3 months. And you can either buy 1 set of 3, or you can sign up for the whole year where you get 4 different sets of 3. And you also get a whole like page of information about the apiary location and the ecology and the different nectar source plants. So if you really want to nerd out, that's kind of fun. And then you can have your little honey flight where you have the 3 different kinds of honey. And we try to include 3 very different kinds of honey. So you'll definitely be able to taste taste the differences. And it's kind of a lot of fun.
That's awesome. Camille, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. People can also find you on Instagram. You're Wayward Spark on Instagram. And Henry is
at Old Blue Raw Honey.
Perfect. So follow them for lots of beautiful pictures of life in the Willamette Valley and honey and bees and delicious things made with honey.
Well, it's that time of year again.
Fava beans.
The fava beans are here.
Yay.
They are really one of my favorite spring things to eat.
Are they?
Mm-hmm.
I love them. They are so fresh and bright and a lot of work, but worth it. Worth the work.
I really don't relish making them at home.
Yeah.
It's the shelling and then...
The second.
With the skin peeling.
Yeah. Do you do both sort of peelings?
How can you not?
Well... Some people skip the second peeling, you know, so they come in a pod and you pop them out of the pod and then the delicious little fava beans are inside sort of a secondary
skin.
And so, you know, you shell them, you cook them, and then you pop them out of that exterior pod or that shell and then saute them or something like that. Mm-hmm. I have seen dishes where people skip the second step, like Italian, very rustic Italian dishes, and then you're sort of expected to deal with the skin on your own.
That's gross.
But it's really more delicious if you just do it.
This is another one I typically leave to restaurants.
Oh, really?
I have to say.
I've done it at times. I've certainly gone through the process, especially when I was I used to write a column about pickling for Serious Eats.
Oh, did you pickle them?
I marinated them. So pop them out of the pods and then pop them out of the skins. And then I did a sort of super garlicky, herby marinade, and so sort of pickled, but marinated fava beans are delicious. They're so
good.
I bet.
I do really like them. I love them in pasta dishes. Mm-hmm. You can make a hummus out of them.
Yeah, God, the work to make a hummus out of them, though.
Yeah,
it's a lot of peeling. And
there's a recipe for the fava hummus in the Zahav.
Is there?
I invite you all to peel them and make them.
I do love a fava bean puree, too. Just
tasty.
Mm-hmm.
I just had an amazing – I was at Liver 2 about a week ago.
Uh-huh.
Their menu is very springy right now, and there was a dish with spring peas and fava beans. It was just so good.
Yeah.
Pasta, of course. I try to eat them up at restaurants while they're gone. Fava beans on toast, that's another good one. Especially mashed. Like, you don't have to make a full puree of it.
Uh-huh, but you just sort of mash them with a fork.
But it is, man, labor intensive.
But worth it. Yeah, I feel like fava beans represent one of those foods to me where they're only here for a short time.
Mm-hmm.
And so doing the work to relish them is worth it because it's not something you're going to be doing all year round. You maybe have 2 or 3 weeks.
If we were super motivated, it would be fun to get a group together to like really do up a lot of them and like also just like chat and gossip and like maybe listen to back episodes of Local Mouthful or whatever and then split them up among the group.
That would be fun. They are good. Well, if you love fava beans, tell us how you prepare them because we're always curious to hear. And you know what? That's it for this week's installment of Local Mouthful. Our thanks go out to Dan Call for editing the show, to Saul Rosenbaum for designing our logo, and to Raina Rose for providing the music. And thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, make sure to subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Local Mouthful. You can also sign up for our newsletter, catch up on past events, and check out our show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.